Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
In May of 2016, you could find this bombshell on newsstands and at the supermarket checkout in your local grocer. It was everywhere. Ted Cruz's father linked to JFK assassination. Top U.S. spy exposes presidential race bombshell. The blood, the mission, the blood money, the mission, and the cover-up. Though there was blood, too. That was the cover of the National Enquirer, alleging that the father of Senator Ted Cruz had been handing out communist propaganda with Lee Harvey Oswald a few months before Oswald killed JFK, which could only mean that Ted Cruz's father was somehow involved with John F. Kennedy's assassination. It was a stretch. But at the time, Trump was running against Cruz for the Republican presidential nomination. Now, Trump was already well on his way to becoming the party's nominee, but Ted Cruz was still hanging on, and he was refusing to leave the race, much to Trump's vexation. And once the Enquirer came out with a conspiracy involving Cruz's dad, Donald Trump wasted no time promoting it. By the morning of May 3rd, Trump was calling in to his favorite morning show.
His father was with Lee Harvey Oswald prior to Oswald's being, shot. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous.
By the end of that day, May 3rd, Ted Cruz had dropped out of the presidential race. But not before responding to Trump's allegations.
You know, Donald's source for this is the National Enquirer. The National Enquirer is tabloid trash. But it's run by his good friend, David Pecker, the CEO, who's endorsed Donald Trump. And so the National Enquirer has become his hit piece that he uses to smear anybody and everybody.
The National Enquirer has become Trump's hit piece that he uses to smear anybody and everybody. 8 years ago, the transactional relationship between Donald Trump and the National Enquirer was so obvious that Ted Cruz was just talking about it on the campaign trail. Now, today was the second day of witness testimony in the first criminal trial of a former president, Donald Trump. And the focus of the testimony was that very same thing that Ted Cruz highlighted 8 years ago, the ways in which the National Enquirer helped Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign. David Pecker, the former CEO of the Enquirer, testified that his tabloid would run negative stories about each of Donald Trump's primary opponents whenever they started to do well in the polls against Trump. Stories like bungling surgeon Ben Carson left sponge in patient's brain. That came out right after a poll that showed Ben Carson leading Trump for the first time. Ben Carson denies that sponge allegation, by the way. And then there was shocking claims, pervy Ted Cruz caught cheating with five secret mistresses. That came out right after a series of polls found Ted Cruz pulling ahead of Donald Trump. What was going down here wasn't even subtle. Trump was using the National Enquirer to smear his opponents and to undermine their candidacies. And the Enquirer was more than willing to oblige. In court today, this is how Mr. Pecker described that process. Pecker, Michael Cohen would call me and say, we would like for you to run a negative article on, let's say, for argument's sake, on Ted Cruz. Then he would send me information about Ted Cruz or Ben Carson or about Marco Rubio. That was the basis of our story, and then we would embellish it from there. Prosecutor Steinglass, you said that Michael Cohen would call you periodically and say, we would like you to run a negative story about this political opponent or that political opponent. Is that correct? Pecker, yes. Steinglass, who did you understand we to be referring to? Pecker, Michael Cohen always told me that he was not part of the campaign, so I only assumed that he was talking to Mr. Trump. When he said we, I thought he was talking about himself and Mr. Trump. David Pecker and the National Enquirer were, by his own admission, publicly influencing the 2016 election on behalf of Donald Trump at the direction of his lawyer. And then there was what prosecutors allege Pecker was doing behind the scenes to help Trump's campaign. Today, prosecutors asked Mr. Pecker about two negative stories about Donald Trump. Stories the National Enquirer purchased the exclusive rights to and then sat on so that the accusations against Trump would not come out before the election. A process that is now known colloquially and publicly as catch and kill. The first of these involved a doorman who alleged Trump had fathered a love child with a housekeeper at Trump Tower. It was a story that the Enquirer determined untrue, but bought anyway so that it couldn't be sold to anyone else. Then there was Karen McDougal, the model and actress who, like Stormy Daniels, alleged she had an affair with Donald Trump. The Enquirer also bought the rights to her story so that she could not go public with it. And what we learned in court today is that all of this behind-the-scenes maneuvering, much like those bombshell cover stories, was for one express purpose, to help the Trump campaign. Here's Prosecutor Steinglass. Now, that part of the deal where you were going to notify them so they could buy up negative information about Mr. Trump, that part, did that part help the National Enquirer at all? How was that going to boost sales of the National Enquirer? Pecker, no, that didn't help. Steinglass, that part doesn't have a mutual benefit. The purpose of that component was to benefit the campaign. Am I understanding you right? Pecker, that is right. The focus on how all of this benefited the Trump campaign is important because the prosecution's central argument in this case, the reason they were able to charge Donald Trump with a felony, is because they say Trump's hush money scheme was all about trying to cover up his criminal activity related to the 2016 election. Prosecutors today revealed that they are planning to rely on Section 17-152 of the New York Criminal Code, which prohibits any two or more persons from conspiring to promote or prevent the election of any person to a public office by unlawful means. And so it is important that Trump's arrangement with the National Enquirer and subsequent hush money payments wasn't just about helping Trump, the man. It was about helping Trump, the candidate, win the election. Joining me now, Duncan Levin, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York, and Jeremy Saland, former assistant DA in the Manhattan DA's trial division. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me here. I am definitely out of my league when I'm talking about codes, criminal codes in New York law. So I defer to you here on exactly what transpired in the courtroom. Duncan, let me just start with you in terms of the prosecution articulating, like, this is at least one of the ways in which what Donald Trump has done here could be seen as a felony. Is that what you understood? I mean, are we getting it right here?
In other words, so. I mean, this is the first time that the DA's case has actually really come into focus.
Yeah.
And it was made clear through the testimony today, but really a telling comment made by one of the prosecutors at a sidebar that this is not a case about falsifying business records.
Yeah.
This is a case about the cover-up of uncharged criminal activity. And today we learn what the uncharged criminal activity is that the DA's office is relying on. And really at the core of it is that New York State election law statute. But it's a conspiracy between Donald Trump, the defendant, David Pecker, the National Enquirer, and Michael Cohen to make illegal payments and suppress stories with the purpose of that being to suppress the stories so that he could win the election.
Right.
And that's what's at the core of it. And now we know what the felony is, why it is that it's been bumped up to a felony, because it was a falsification of business records for the purpose of committing this New York State election lawsuit.
We keep saying election. I think it's important, right? Because it's not Trump's sort of semi-defense. It's not been fully articulated. Is that at least with some of these stories, or one of them, it was to protect his family, right? But what's being alleged here by the prosecution is this wasn't about you and Melania or your family. This was about you, the candidate, which is why they brought those examples in featuring Ted Cruz and Ben Carson. We went over them at the beginning of the segment, not just to treat everybody to National Enquirer headlines, but to, I think they made a pretty good point there, right? There's a history here of the Enquirer acting expressly in a political capacity, help Trump in an expressly political capacity.
Absolutely. And if you credit Pecker's testimony, what did he say? Well, he said that I had that meeting in 2015. Mm-hmm. What happened at that meeting? It was Michael Cohen. It was Donald Trump. And the question in substance is, what can you do to help the campaign? And right. he said, I'm going to be your eyes and your ears. Why are you saying that? But for no other reason, to assist the former president, then he wasn't obviously the potential president, in his campaign. And then we learn what? He's killing stories. It first starts with the $30,000 for the doorman for the alleged baby story. Then we have McDougal. But at the same time, to your point, we also have bad stories about Hillary Clinton. We have bad stories about Ted Cruz. So this was the machine, the vehicle for Donald Trump to do his dirty deeds and promote himself.
What did you make of Pecker's testimony just as a witness? I wasn't in the courtroom, and our eyes and ears into the actual sort of tenor of it are somewhat limited. But from the transcripts and from the reporting that you've seen, what is he? How effective was he as a narrator?
I think he is the case. And without David Pecker, there is no case. He puts himself at the center of it. He talks about how we get to Donald Trump. He talks about where Michael Cohen fits in on this. Michael Cohen is the conduit between Donald Trump and the National Enquirer. This whole scheme rises and falls through Michael Cohen to Donald Trump. And he is at the center of it. And I think, in a way, his testimony is almost blasé. Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. we were acting, but, you know, doing this and doing that. But he was, the National Enquirer was an arm of the Trump campaign. And that comes out really clearly in the testimony. And the timing becomes so interesting because, for example, this doorman had an NDA which expired the month that Trump wins the election. You can see why this is all about the election. And David Pecker is the first witness. He's the most important witness. He's at the center of it all.
The reality is that David Pecker is going to be cross-examined. What questions would you have for him, given how thorough and also, I mean, it's all fairly sensational, but he was so matter of fact in delivering the information to the courtroom, to the jurors. What would your sort of strategy be if you're Trump's defense?
A large part of this is that he had immunity. And whenever someone has immunity, there's a reason why they have immunity. They have exposure. And if you have exposure, what are you going to do? You're going to lie. At least that's the theory. So that's a main or a big angle to attack. But I just want to follow up to Duncan's point that Pecker is really sort of the hub here, and everything's a spoke off of him. He is so critical to the case. I don't know if he's the center of the case in that as much as Duncan necessarily believes, because you still need Michael Cohen. But the principle of what he's saying is accurate, that without Pecker, Cohen doesn't have the credibility because he lacks it on his own two feet. He needs Pecker. He needs David Pecker to stand up for him. So does Stormy Daniels. They need him. He is so critical. So to undress him and take him down, I think you're starting with that immunity issue.
Do you feel, if you're Donald Trump and you're his team, there are three people involved in this conspiracy. One of them is Michael Cohen, who's going to be a witness for the prosecution. One of them is Dave Pecker, who's just taken the stand and been very favorable to the prosecution. Where does that leave Donald Trump? I mean, do you think this puts pressure on him to take the stand, or is that too far-fetched to imagine?
Well, I think it's unlikely that he'll testify for so many reasons, not the least of which is that the cross-examination is going to be brutal. But one of the things that the prosecution is going to have to prove is that Donald Trump knew that what he was doing was breaking the law. There's a knowledge element here. It has to be done with the intent to break the law. And one way he could show that is by testifying and say, you know, I didn't know that these entries were being made. I didn't know that I was doing this with the intent of violating the Federal Election Campaign Act. He could do that through his testimony. I highly doubt he'll do it, but I do think that you heard a lot of speak from Todd Blanch in the opening statement, which is called lawyer talk. It's not evidence in the case. And I don't know how they're going to prove the lack of knowledge on Mr. Trump's behalf, but one way he could do it would be to testify.
They do have people in the list of potential witnesses. There are some high-level Trump Organization officials who are prepared to testify, who presumably would further corroborate the idea that Donald Trump knew what he was doing. I mean, is there a witness that you've seen from the list of people that may be called to the stand that could be helpful to Trump's case at this point?
Helpful? Not necessarily. If you have witnesses putting Michael Cohen in the Oval Office with you, that's not helpful. If you have a witness saying that Donald Trump was, you know, meticulous in looking over his checks and signing his checks, and he wasn't sort of a passive player here, that's not helpful to you. So there's nobody that the prosecution is lining up that will be helpful. I mean, Josh Steinglass and Chris Conroy, it's not their first rodeo. They know what they're doing. So I'm overwhelmingly confident Donald Trump's in trouble, but it's not his burden. It's the prosecution's burden.
Right.
And it's that beyond the reasonable doubt, which is not always an easy thing. And that is why, back to what we started off with, how important David Pecker is to give credibility and validating what this is about. Because otherwise, why? Why would you sign off? Who cares about hush money? There needs to be some nexus. And that's what these witnesses will show.
Do you have any suspicion of what they might try and do in the cross?
Of David Pecker?
Yeah.
I think they're going to do everything they can to show that he's a liar, that what he's saying is not only ill-informed, but that he's doing it because he got a non-prosecution agreement. The U.S. Attorney's Office has forced his hand, forced him there today, and he's trying to cover his bases by lying. And it's really the only move they have. Poke holes in the case one witness at a time, and that's what they're going to be doing with David Pecker starting probably tomorrow or the day after.
Well, we shall see. I mean, listen, we may know this story quite well, at least the broad contours of it. But when it comes down to the actual trial, there is so much to dig into. Jeremy Saland, thank you so much for your time tonight. Duncan, I think we have lassoed you in for one more block, so please stay right there. Coming up at long last, Congress votes to send aid to Ukraine. But don't ask anyone in the Republican Party if this means the debate is settled. And coming up, as we await Judge Merchan's ruling on Trump's gag order, prosecutors are now suggesting that maybe Trump wants to go to prison. Maybe. More on that coming up next.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
The sixth day of Donald Trump's hush money trial began with a contempt hearing to determine whether the former president should be fined for attacking witnesses on social media in direct violation of a gag order imposed by Judge Juan Merchan. Prosecutors opened the hearing, asking the judge to impose the maximum fine of $1,000 for each of the 10 alleged violations. They also asked Judge Merchan to warn Trump about the possibility of jail time. This is Prosecutor Chris Conroy. We are not yet seeking an incarceratory penalty. The defendant seems to be angling for that. Conroy added that the court should warn the defendant that this conduct will not be tolerated and remind him that incarceration is an option should it be necessary. This was the response from Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche. There was absolutely no willful violation of the gag order in the 10 posts that the prosecution just discussed. Those comments were in direct response to comments made by these witnesses, not about these criminal proceedings, Your Honor. When Judge Merchan pressed Mr. Blanche on what specific attacks Trump was responding to, Blanche struggled to answer, which led the judge to say, I have asked you 8 or 9 times to show me the exact posts that Trump was responding to, and you have been unable to do that even once. Blanche's response, President Trump is being very careful to comply with your honor's rules. Judge Merchan, you, Mr. Blanche, you are losing all credibility. I have to tell you that right now. Joining me now, Duncan Levin, former assistant U.S. attorney with the Manhattan DA's office, and Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Alabama. Thank you both for being here. Joyce, what are the implications of losing the confidence of the judge in like 48 hours?
So, yeah, I mean, it's never a good thing, right, Alex? I think that we're all trying to find different ways to express the fact that this is the worst development for Donald Trump's lawyers this early in the trial. And their client has forced it upon them. If Donald Trump were a normal defendant, his lawyers would have taken him out of the courtroom, sat him down, and had a meeting with him where they would have said to him, we cannot defend you if you continue to do this. They may well have had that conversation because Trump's posts on Truth Social tonight have involved attacks on the judge, attacks on Alvin Bragg, the district attorney, but he seems to have stopped talking, at least for the moment, about witnesses. But frankly, it's too late. The judge, I think, is slow to anger. This is a very good judge, a judge who has good control in the courtroom. The fact that he had this level of response to Todd Blanche's attempt to justify Trump's conduct does not bode well for the defense going forward.
Yeah, what does it say about the defense's broader strategy here? We knew this gag order hearing was coming, and this is the best the defense could come up with. Donald Trump is trying really hard to obey your orders when quite obviously he's not.
Well, I don't think they're arguing to the judge as much as they're putting on a show for their own client. I mean, they're making an argument that is not an argument that they know is the winning argument, and this could not have gone any worse for them today, and they had to expect that. If they really wanted to win the argument, they would have said, you know, he went past the line or went up to the line, and he's sorry, and he won't do it again, and it would have ended right there. But he's making this argument, which is a political argument, and I think as a result of it, this notion of losing credibility with the judge, this early in the case is a serious problem, and it's costing them in real world ways. For example, they're not getting to see who the next witness is for the next day. And that's the kind of preparation that lawyers do when they're on trial. They spend all night prepping for the next day's witness. If they don't know who it is, that's the kind of thing that's going to trip them up and really harm Mr. Trump at the end of the day.
You know, I was also struck, as I know many people were, Joyce, about the contention from the prosecution that Donald Trump is angling maybe to be incarcerated here. Can you talk to that and how feasible that suggestion sounds to you?
Right. So, you know, with Donald Trump, who fundraises every time a judge rules against him, every time he's indicted, I think we can't reject that notion out of hand. The reality of Donald Trump losing even more control, you know, he's struggling to stay in a courtroom without standing up and trying to leave, complaining about the temperature. I think even a brief stay in one of the holding cells in the courthouse would be very difficult for him. Nonetheless, there may be some political appeal to him. His base, you know, there have not exactly been large supportive rallies for him outside of the courthouse. Perhaps this would be something that he would view as rallying the base. But the reality is that for so many Americans who have Trump fatigue at this point, the spectacle of watching the former president go into custody might finally be that bridge too far.
Yeah, I'm with Joyce on the utility of, you know, an hour or two in a holding cell for Donald Trump as a matter of stoking political grievance. But I don't know. That just seems very like a very, very difficult decision for the judge to make.
Well, I think what's much more likely to happen is that the judge is going to impose the fine that the prosecutors are going to ask for. Remember, $1,000 is the maximum that he can get. It's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket for him, obviously. So I think that $1,000 fine for him is worth $1 million ad that he could put on TV. What he could do fundraising off of $1,000 fine from Judge Merchan in this case to say that he is being silenced and fined, and they are trying to suppress his right to speak, and they don't want him to become president. He is going to use this for all it's worth. So I think whether it's a few hours in a holding cell or a few $1,000 fine, I think he is going to use this for all it's worth. And I think that's the reason you're seeing more posts coming out tonight. He's angling for a fight. He is not shying away from it. And he's basically putting the judge in a corner where there's really nothing else that he can do.
I mean, well, the other piece of this, aside from the sort of political utility and what it means for the justice system, is what it does to the actual jurors who are serving on this, right? I mean, some of the stuff that Trump has been saying, specifically the reposting of Jesse Waters about liberal activists who are lying to the judge in order to get on the Trump jury. We saw yesterday morning that one of these jurors came in, the second one, with some real trepidation about serving on the jury here. And I guess I wonder, Joyce, if you're a lawyer in this, are you thinking, okay, we're going to need to go to alternate jurors at a certain point?
You know, there is that risk. That's why Judge Merchan went ahead and took the unusual step of putting six alternate jurors on this case. In a normal case, expected to last, you know, a couple of weeks, you might have two or three alternate jurors. this is a problem here, and it points to a larger problem, which is that the jurors shouldn't be exposed to any of this. The jurors are supposed to not see the news. They're supposed to tell folks around them, don't talk to me about the news. In a perfect world, they would have no understanding about what Donald Trump is doing and whether, you know, a host on another network is talking about them and outing their identity. But we live in a real world where that seems to be happening. That could have some complicated impacts in this case if there are convictions and if there is an appeal. For now, though, the judge will do his best to reassure jurors, and he will do his best to make sure that they understand that they must strictly avoid any external news, that they are obligated at this point by virtue of the oath that they took to serve to hear only the evidence that's presented to them in the courtroom.
It is such a stress test for the system, the people involved. I mean, I keep going back to Judge Mershon as well. Like, he is really the most vulnerable person in all of this, given the fact that, you know, Trump can continue to say whatever he wants about the judge on social media. He's not part of the gag order. He has to make these monumental decisions in terms of history. And if he is pushed to put Trump in a holding cell for even an hour, that then becomes a line that's been crossed, right? I mean, we've never seen that before in American history.
It's the job he signed up for, and it's the jurors are in a different spot because even under the most normal of conditions, it's hard to look somebody in the eye and convict them and send them to jail. That's difficult anytime. But in this case, these jurors have such a difficult task knowing that there could be actual physical violence against them. They're all in a spot where this has a real world implication. And it's got to be very scary being on the jury and frankly, even just being the judge and being around all that.
Yeah. I mean, we still don't. The Judge Angoron and the in the Tish James case, I think, no, that Judge Kaplan in the E. Jean Carroll case suggested that jurors not reveal their identities, not talk about who they are. To this day, we have no idea who those men and women were. And that is a testament to the vulnerability of these people who are doing their civic duty. And we are very thankful to them. Duncan Levin, Joyce Vance, thank you both for making the time. Really appreciate it. Still ahead tonight, pro-life. Arizona wants to be senator. Carrie Lake flip-flops once again on her support for Arizona's Civil War-era abortion ban. It is yet another example of Republicans who cannot seem to figure out what they actually want. We'll have more on that coming up next.
This episode is brought to you by Paycor, the HR and payroll software made for leaders. It's never been harder to recruit, hire, and engage workers. That's why HR leaders and frontline managers depend on Paycor for all things people management, from onboarding and performance reviews to compensation and benefits. Learn more at paycor.com/leaders. That's paycor.com/leaders.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
I support trying to save as many babies as possible.
First of all, I am pro-life, and I want to save as many babies as possible.
Our first priority is to save as many babies as possible.
Last year, Arizona Senate candidate Carrie Lake was very clear about being pro-life and anti-choice. A year earlier, she had made abundantly clear that the Civil War-era zombie law, the one banning nearly all abortions in the state of Arizona, that law was a great one, again, according to Carrie Lake.
I'm incredibly thrilled that we are going to have a great law that's already on the books. So it will prohibit abortion in Arizona.
But then, 2 weeks ago, that zombie law became actual law, thanks to a ruling from the state Supreme Court. And Carrie Lake had second thoughts.
I want to make sure that every woman who finds herself pregnant has more choices. If you look at where the population is on this, a full ban on abortion is not where the people are.
I am very pro-life. The near complete ban is a great law. Wait, no. A full ban on abortion is not where the people are at. Are you following this? Stay with me here because Carrie Lake has a new opinion on this subject again. Here she is on Saturday.
When this law passed, the Arizona Supreme Court said this is the law of Arizona. But unfortunately, the people running our state have said we're not going to enforce it. So it's really political theater. We don't have that law as much as many of us wish we did.
We don't have that law as much as many of us wish we did. It's unfortunate that Democrats aren't enforcing it. Except it's not a good law because most people aren't for it. Except it's a great law. What? This is the modern day Republican Party, a party that cannot figure out what it wants. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson in 2022 was firmly against providing more U.S. aid to Ukraine. He voted against Ukraine aid on four separate occasions. But once he was elected speaker last year, according to the reporting from The Washington Post, he began sitting in on high-level intelligence briefings and Speaker Johnson changed his mind. But when Johnson tried to get his own party on board with Ukraine aid, barely half of them agreed. In fact, the only reason the House was able to approve $95 billion for Ukraine, Israel, and U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific this past weekend was because Democrats came to the rescue. That does not mean the Republican infighting is over. Far from it. Trump ally Marjorie Taylor Greene is still threatening to oust Speaker Johnson for daring to cross the aisle. That is even though Trump himself publicly defended Johnson on Monday, saying, "I think he's trying very hard." But if you thought Trump would be the final word on this, think again. Yesterday, Trump whisperer Steve Bannon announced that Trump is actually livid about what Speaker Johnson did on Ukraine.
"He does not support you, Johnson, 100%. Trust me. He's furious about what happened."
Just to recap here, according to Republicans, Ukraine aid is very bad, unless it is urgently necessary. But even if you think it is urgently necessary, it is probably, almost certainly, a catastrophically bad idea. And don't even mention the word abortion. We're going to talk more about the rudderless Republican Party and what Democrats can and should do about it with the great Claire McCaskill coming up next. Just moments ago, the Senate passed a package of four bills to provide billions in foreign aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Those bills are now headed to President Joe Biden's desk for his signature. They received the bipartisan support. They received bipartisan support tonight, but this final passage only happened because House Democrats bailed out Republican Speaker Mike Johnson last weekend. Joining me now to talk about all that is Claire McCaskill, former U.S. Senator from the great state of Missouri. Claire, thank you for joining me here. And I kind of wonder, is this a moment? I mean, there have been a lot of conflicting headlines about who deserves credit here. Quite obviously, Democrats do for bailing out the Republican Speaker of the House and members of his own party, getting it through the Rules Committee and out of the House. But do you think Mike Johnson deserves credit? Does he get a gold star for bucking the hardliners in the Republican conference?
I may choke a little when I say this. But probably he got the high level intel briefings. He listened to the commanders. I think he spent some time talking with people in Europe who he knows are our allies. And I think he figured out that he didn't want to be with Putin at this moment. He didn't want to be the American who allowed Putin to roll over a democracy. And that it was very dangerous for our country and would end up costing our country even more, not just in money, but maybe even in lives sacrificed in a much bigger and broader conflict. So, yeah, he gets a gold star, but there's gold stars other places. I got to give kind of a gold star. I'm going to choke again to Mitch McConnell because he didn't give up. He actually got more Republicans to vote for the Ukraine aid tonight than he did back in February. He got the majority of his caucus tonight. He did not get them back in February. And frankly, Chuck Schumer is not getting enough credit for keeping, you know, he has the same margin, Alex, as yes. the Republicans have in the House.
Yes.
He only has 51.
It's so important to point that out. Well, that's how one party manages a one-seat majority.
Exactly. And look how many times he's kept the Democrats together when it really mattered. And we have a lot of different opinions in our party right now, especially when it comes to the conflict, the horrific war in Gaza right now. So, I think the leaders writ large in Congress get gold stars tonight, even though I grudgingly give it out to Mitch McConnell and Mike Johnson.
Well, listen, I don't think you're wrong to be begrudging in your gold star distribution, just because it feels like Johnson's desire to pass this Ukraine aid bill was based on intelligence and sort of a substantive, a real feeling about the preservation of democracy. And yet it's hard to imagine that he's really making that case to his party as the war in Ukraine goes on, or as he talks about the sort of general foreign policy position of the Republican Party. I mean, it doesn't feel like he's going to use this as a moment to lead and to bring his party back from the hinterlands of isolationism, when quite clearly he believes that's what's necessary for the betterment of the global order.
Yeah, but contrast him with who I think needs a dunce cap in the corner. Like put this in your pipe and smoke it. Marco Rubio voted no today. Marco Rubio is the ranking member of the Intelligence Committee in the United States Senate. Nobody has more intelligence than Marco Rubio, but he doesn't have the intelligence to go with it or the backbone. So it is really interesting that he is siding with Trump in this, even though he knows better. And so did another 16 or 17 Republicans in the Senate and a whole boatload of them in the House. So this is really about, are you with Trump and Putin, or are you with really national security and protecting democracies and freedom across the globe?
Are you drawing a larger inference about what this might suggest in terms of House leadership? I mean, do you think that this means Mike Johnson's ready to do deals with moderate Democrats and sort of move things forward here? Or is this a one-time thing?
Well, I don't know. I don't think much will move now. I mean, he's still got to keep the government funded. And so that might be another power move he's going to have to try to make. I think he knows he is on very, very thin ice right now, because the far right crazy caucus is so angry. It could be worse. He could be running for the Senate in Arizona and not even know how he feels about an issue that I think doesn't lend itself to flip-flopping very easily. And that is our star out in Arizona, Carrie Lake, who can't decide who she is or why she's running.
Yeah, well, I feel like her inability to take a position on this is so exemplary of a party that really that knows better, but is not listening to the thing. They're not listening to their brains. They're not listening to their better angels, and they're not listening to the information.
They're listening to the loudest voices. She flipped again because the loud voices are screaming at her. You cannot be against this bill from the 1800s. You must be for this bill. And, you know, the bill isn't even in effect yet. It will be in come summer, it will be. And local prosecutors still have the ability to bring cases. So she's not even accurate when she says that it can't be enforced or won't be enforced. But she is somebody who thinks if she talks really, I mean, she's so telegenic and she's got that flawless makeup and she gets the really soft shots and she says it all so clearly. She actually believes that people will buy whatever she's selling and they don't see that she has no principle on this issue. And there's one thing that people hate more than somebody who disagrees with them on an issue like this. That's someone who has no principles on an issue like this. She loses votes from both sides.
I'll just say, I think you're telegenic and I love your shot. And I can see a cake in the background, which makes me love it.
Oh, it's scones. It's scones. It's
even
blueberry, blueberry scones. I'd get you a cup of hot tea if you were here and we'd have a scone.
I mean, give me the ticket. Claire McCaskill, thank you for joining. Thank you and your blueberry scones for joining me tonight for some real talk. I appreciate it. Coming up, protests at campuses across America have led to a surge in heated rhetoric, as well as unsupported accusation and conflicting narratives on all sides. We're going to speak to the head of Columbia University's student newspaper about what has and has not been happening on that campus coming up next. There are now more than a dozen encampment-style protests on college campuses across the country, signifying resistance to the war in Gaza and what students see as their college's ties to Israel. Along with these protests are claims that the protests are contributing to a climate of anti-Semitism on campus and a debate about where to draw the line between freedom of speech and safety on campus. That debate is happening not only in schools, but also in the national press and in the halls of Congress. And it has led to the arrest and suspension of hundreds of students across multiple campuses. At the epicenter of all of this is the encampment-style protest currently on day six at Columbia University. Since the very first protests and claims of anti-Semitic incidents following last year's October 7th attack, the college paper, the Columbia Spectator, has been on the scene. No paper has covered the protests, the backlash, and the transformation of Columbia's campus as extensively, with as much detail, or with as much access to all of the subjects involved as the Columbia Spectator. All these headlines you see on screen right now are just from today. So for a better understanding of what is actually happening there, joining me now is Isabella Ramirez, editor-in-chief of the Columbia Spectator. Isabella, thank you so much for being here. I'm really, really appreciative of all the reporting you've done, what the paper is doing, and for being on set tonight. I know that this has been kind of a quickly moving storm front, if you will. Can you tell us what the latest is as the administration tries to sort of manage this crisis?
So just minutes prior to this, Columbia students just received a new email from President Manoush Shafiq outlining there have been ongoing conversations between the administration and the organizers behind the encampment and these protests. And Shafiq has just recently outlined a deadline for when those conversations must come to a reconciliation. Or, as she said in a pretty explicit way, they will seek, quote, alternative options for clearing West Lawn. Now, there was sort of some vagueness as to what that could imply. There wasn't any sort of direct mention of the New York Police Department. But of course, looking at the recent events, looking not only at what happened on our campus on Thursday, but what now has spread to New York University and several universities across the nation, we can't help but to sort of, especially at the Columbia Daily Spectator, be on edge and be ready for the potential that we could relive what occurred on Thursday.
Can you, it's been hard for people who are not on campus to understand exactly what the dynamic is. You know, there's claims of, you know, violence, anti-Semitic incidents, face-offs. Can you, to the best of your abilities, I know that there's a lot happening here. Give me a sense of how contentious it is, how dangerous it feels, and what the sort of general tenor is between the pro-Palestinian groups of students and the pro-Israel students.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly complicated thing to describe. And I think the best way to describe it is, you know, as a student who is currently there and navigating the space, there are different characterizations to the extent to which people feel safe. And I think we've tried to navigate that very, very particularly by, you know, yes, there have been anti-Semitic incidences. A lot of them, however, have been attached specifically to off-campus protests. A lot of them have been attached to non-affiliates who have been, protesting outside of our campus, sometimes in solidarity, you know, or in solidarity with those encampments.
But not actually at the encampment itself?
Not necessarily. That's not to say that there hasn't been incidences as well on our campus. There was some particular incidences that happened over this past Saturday, what we call at the sundial. And there were kind of a few violent remarks that were made and also a specific sign that was held by one singular protester away from the encampment, again, not on the lawns, but very close by, that did refer to Hamas's military wing. And so people have, of course, pointed to those incidences, and that is that is something that we should condemn, or that is something that we should contend with as a campus body. But also there's this very interesting element that I think if you weren't really deeply involved in the campus and you weren't seeing the encampment for yourself and walking onto it, of this micro community that is being formed on this lawn. And what I mean by that is they have regular programming, which is to say they have movie nights and dance performances, and they have a list of community guidelines. And one of the first guidelines on that list is do not engage with counter protesters. You know, try to de-escalate. Don't try to engage with agitators. And in fact, when some of those anti-Semitic incidences happened on our campus and also off campus on Saturday, Columbia University Apartheid Divest, sort of the big coalition behind this encampment, did, you know, to an extent, denounce those incidences and say, remember, guys, like, this is what we're here for. We're here in support of Palestinians, and we're here also to demand from the university to potentially divest from its ties to Israel. And so, you know, understanding all of those moving pieces, it is a lot more nuanced than a lot of people, I think, or how media has been able to portray it. And it's more visible to us. Just this past, you know, on Monday, yesterday, for the commencement of Passover, there was a Seder.
Yes, at the encampment.
And that's an incredibly interesting display of why it's important not to display this as monolithic or as even two-sided.
Right.
I think there are...
It's multifaceted.
Certainly multifaceted. There are people on so many different dimensions, identities that belong to pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian causes. And it can be very dangerous sometimes when we attempt to generalize, but also attempt to make it simple. And I think that's what Spectator can do, is we don't just catch the biggest stories. We catch every element that
comes. That's why, honestly, it is essential reading in this moment. Isabella Ramirez, editor-in-chief of the Columbia Spectator, thank you so much for everything you're doing to cover this topic. That is our show for this evening.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.